Getting help for mental health shouldn't be as hard as it is. Mindful Therapy Group is here to make your mental health journey as painless as possible. Mindful partners with thousands of licensed clinicians to find the perfect fit for you, and also accepts insurance. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com.
Welcome back, folks. Tension is escalating in Ukraine. President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday formally lowered the threshold for Russia's use of its nuclear weapons, a move that follows U.S. President Joe Biden's decision to let Ukraine strike targets inside of Russian territory with U.S.-provided ordnance. And here to talk to us about is Daniel DePetris, Defense Priorities Fellow, Daniel, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Newell. Thanks for having me again.
Thank you for joining us. And also, the U.S. Embassy announced that it's closing in Kyiv. I guess these are all indications of the tension rising. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the Biden administration has been deliberating for well over a year now as to whether to provide the Ukrainians, you know, the ATACMS, what we refer to as the ATACMS missiles, which are, medium-range ballistic missiles that can hit Russian military targets deeper into the country. The Russians, understandably, have warned the United States and other NATO allies that have this capability to refrain from providing the Ukrainians with those missiles. And Biden this week, after much deliberation with his advisors, decided to go the other way and basically give these missiles to the Ukrainians. And I think what we have here is the Russians responding to that move by essentially publishing, a change in its nuclear doctrine, which, as you laid out, does decrease the threshold, does lower the threshold for possible Russian nuclear use inside Ukraine or even outside Ukraine.
Daniel, kind of curious about the timing. What evidence, what has been provided to the Biden administration to make them believe that this change in strategy and the benefits that flow from this really outweigh the risk of escalation? That's what the Biden administration is saying. Would this not have been true 6 months ago?
Yeah, it's a very strange situation because, you know, you read the press releases and the transcripts of U.S. officials explaining this decision. And it's mainly based on what they say is it's a response to, the North Koreans deploying 10 to 12,000 troops inside Russia, which the United States views as a pretty significant escalation. They almost never talk about whether giving Ukraine ATACMS missiles would actually have any military utility in the war, which I find pretty telling. So this seems to be more of a political decision on Biden's part than anything that would have significant military advantages on behalf of the Ukrainians.
I mean, I guess you sense a little bit of the skepticism in my voice. I'm just kind of curious, are these legacy decisions? I mean, I just kind of find them as odd.
It's very strange, and you're right to point out the legacy thing. You know, Biden is going to be out of here in 2 months, and I think there was a very, behind the scenes, very difficult conversation over a span of months between Biden and his advisors, who just really could not come around to a common decision about these missiles. The Defense Department, it should be noted, was probably the most skeptical department within the interagency about providing these missiles. In main reason because we don't have a lot of them in the U.S. stockpiles. So for whatever reason, Biden 2 months out has decided to finally make a decision. And Trump, whether or not he backtracks on what Biden just did or continues along with it is really open to interpretation. We just don't know yet, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, as it relates to the reach of these missiles, we know that there was a lot inside of Russia that was target rich, right?
Yeah, the problem is that, the administration has been talking about this for so long that the Russians have used it as an opportunity to basically redeploy a lot of their aircraft outside of the range of the ATACMS, which is about 190 to 200 miles So, you know, I think it was a U.S. official back in September briefing the press on this, basically said 90% of Russia's attack aircraft are now outside of the range of ATACMS. So, again, I don't know what the administration thinks this latest decision is going to do for the Ukrainians militarily, but, you know, this is the decision Biden took. And as you know, I'm probably skeptical about it, and you seem to be skeptical about it, too. And you're right to be skeptical.
Well, I mean, I am, because obviously, I mean, Zelensky has been reaching out to members of NATO, European Union, the U.S. and others, asking for this privilege of in the utilization of the assets that have been provided. And it's been a resounding no or no answer. And it's just interesting that on this date, you know, in November, you know, we decide, oh, this is a good time to do this. And then you talk about, especially with personnel minds. I mean, you know, because there's a whole body of people that are adamantly opposed to this. I don't think the U.S. has signed off on it. You would know. I don't. But, you know, that now we're going to be providing this as well. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, the anti-personnel mines are obviously a little different. I mean, you can consider those defensive weapons. So, you know, with the Ukrainians, they would obviously use those lines to solidify their positions in Donetsk and Luhansk and all those towns and villages that are continuing to get battered by the Russian offensive. So that in itself is militarily speaking, that makes sense to me, at least. Mm-hmm. What doesn't make sense is the ATACMS, which, again, if the Russians have already moved a lot of their military assets outside of the range of what the ATACMS can hit, what is the point? You know, so that's why I come around to this was probably a political decision outweighing military considerations.
Yeah, but I think what highlights that even more is the way that you appropriately laid it out with these anti-personnel mines. Why now? I mean, the value of this has been established over a year ago.
Frankly, the Ukrainians could have protected
their flanks for a long time, you know, with the utilization of this, right?
That's absolutely correct. And you have, you know, you have people within the Pentagon who are very adamant that, you know, the best way for the Ukrainians to go forward is by focusing on defense, right? Defensive operations, keeping what they have, but acknowledging that, you know, offensive operations will probably strain the Ukrainians' manpower even further than it is now. So this is another one of those considerations where it's like, well, yeah, why are we doing this in November 2024 when it probably could have been done earlier in the year, if not last year?
I think yesterday the Ukrainians utilized one of the American-made missiles to strike into Russia for the first time. Your crystal ball, where does this move in the coming weeks, knowing that January 20th looms out there? It's not that far away, 2 months from today, exactly. And so what happens over this next 60 days?
Yeah, as you said, it's a transition period here in the United States, right? So, you know, we're probably over the next 2 months, we're going to see similar ATACMS-related strikes inside Russia, probably targeting munitions facilities, you know, oil facilities, anything that's logistics-related that will make it more difficult for the Russians to sustain their operations inside Russia and inside eastern Ukraine. And, you know, essentially, Putin will probably use this decision as a reaffirmation of his strategy. You know, I think the administration thinks that with enough military pressure, Putin will come to the table and seek out a deal. And I think what he's demonstrated over the last, you know, close to 3 years now is when he's backed into a corner militarily, he redoubles his efforts and he escalates. And, you know, the question is how does Russia escalate over the next 2 months? I think there will be escalation, but, you know, I'm not prepared to sit here today and tell you what that's going to look like.
Yeah, it's going to, I think it's a very sensitive period of time that we have going on here. And I think there'll be a lot of saber rattling for sure. Right. I'm kind of curious, the the incursion by the Ukrainians into Russia, have they still been able to hold on to that piece of territory or geography?
Yeah, so the Ukrainians, you know, went into Kursk back in August. They have lost, I believe, about one-third of the territory that they captured back in the summer. But they do, you know, they are still holding on to a portion of Kursk. The decision, you know, I always come back to the big picture, which is what was the point of this counteroffensive to begin with? The Ukrainian right. government seems to believe that it was going to basically provide it with more leverage at the negotiating table, you know, in the event that talks actually happened. And even more so that it would force the Russians to sort of redeploy their forces back to Russia. Neither of those things have happened. So, yes, the Ukrainians are holding on to some portions of that province, but in terms of actually aiding their war effort, I'm not sure it has done anything positive in relation to that.
Yeah. Interestingly, how do you read, departing for a moment and thinking about China, President Xi Jinping's move across the globe and showing up here, there, and everywhere, and really kind of sending a message of, I don't know if I'd call it reconciliation or what, but a softer message, so to speak. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Xi Jinping has certainly redoubled his diplomatic efforts, particularly in Europe, where, you know, Chinese trade ties are still worth hundreds of billions of euros. So it's extremely profitable for China and for Europe. There's kind of a mutual benefit to that. But you're also seeing the Chinese diplomats actually softening their messages to the United States as well, which is quite significant, considering Trump will be in the White House in 2 months, and I think what that indicates is the Chinese are either nervous about what Trump will do in terms of his economic policy and his kind of obsession with tariffs, and he's also obviously trying to determine whether China can establish a working productive relationship with the next administration. So. What we're seeing here is, I think, a preface to what we could be seeing in 2 months, which is maybe a mini detente, depending on how Trump approaches the China problem.
Is there a path to the resolution of Ukraine through Xi Jinping?
Many speculate that, Xi could maybe convince Putin to kind of downgrade his more maximalist objectives in Ukraine. I don't buy that for the simple reason that Ukraine seems so important to Putin personally and so vital to Russian national security that Putin will probably only listen to himself. Yes, the Chinese have extreme economic leverage over Russia, but number one, China is not willing to exercise it, not willing to use that leverage. And even if it did, I'm not sure Putin would take much cadence into what Xi is recommending one way or the other. But we'll see. That's just an assessment on my part. Other scholars and experts have different opinions.
Yeah, I was kind of curious, Daniel, because in light of what's going on with NATO, with some of the new memberships, with Finland and otherwise, that strategic importance, some say it's heightened and some say, whether you're attacked from the north or the south, or both at the same time at this juncture is really not of much consequence to them. I mean, it just kind of begs of being more aggressive in the diplomatic arena as opposed to anything else. Your thoughts?
Yeah, the NATO question in specifically is not going away, right? I mean, so even when Trump was during Trump's first term, NATO expanded to two new countries. And that has always been an extreme irritant, not only for Putin, but for prior presidents, including going back to the Soviet Union. So this NATO expansion thing seems to be sort of like the ghost that hovers over Washington, because so many people in Capitol Hill and in the White House view it as a sound policy. And I've always been a very big skeptic of NATO expansion because, you know, you expand the alliance, you're giving the United States more responsibility to defend more countries. And the question is, A, do we want to do that militarily? B, do we have the capacity to do it? And then C, is it even in our interest to do it? Or is it in our interest to expand alliance? And I would say no. I mean, that door is closed. It should have closed a decade ago, quite frankly.
Yeah, it just seems to me that, I mean, it's curious. North Korea sends, you know, some troops. I'm sure that Putin would have loved to have had some from China as well. I know that they're getting some kind of aid from China. But if I do believe, and I'm curious whether you do, that Xi will minimize that if it takes that in order to really solidify trade and otherwise with the United States.
Oh, I think that's 100% correct. You know, I mean, the war has been going on for nearly 30 years now. And as you mentioned, the Chinese have aided Russia's defense industrial complex, but they haven't done it by sending weapons, right? Or big ticket right. defense platforms. So, you know, the Chinese aren't stupid. They know how to play both sides of the ledger here, and they've been doing it quite well. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it, you know?
Yeah, and I guess that's why I've always kind of been curious if really the path to this is China pushing their thumb on Putin. Because without China protecting, you know, Putin, I where does he go? There's not many people left of any consequence, you know. I mean, if you go to the Middle East and you get Iran a little bit on the run and them in a defensive posture, and North Korea is the only one standing out there, well, that ain't enough, right? And
right, I mean, but,
you know,
yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, the question is always whether the Chinese would be willing to use the like I said earlier, whether they would be willing to use the leverage that they have over the Russians. And it's not a one way relationship. It's actually a pretty symbiotic relationship. So China
really?
Views Russia as I mean, China views Russia as a key diplomatic player and a key strategic player in its overall policy in terms of the United States. So I think the last thing that Xi Jinping wants to do is lose Russia as a strategic partner. That, you know, they're not allies per se. They're not traditional allies. They're not going to go to war for each other or die for each other. But their partnership has really been elevated over the last 3 to 4 years. And I don't think China would want to even jeopardize that. So that's the big question that U.S. policymakers are kind of facing is how do we push the Chinese when the Chinese don't want to be pushed?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. And a lot of people, you know, I think about this in this respect, but they don't really say it. The traditional sense of an ally was, you know, you would hear the word trust more often, right? You don't hear that word very often any longer in talking about allies. It's just kind of ironic.
Yeah, it's a bit. And in terms of the Russia-China relationship specifically, there is no trust between those two countries, and a lot of that is historical, right? You know, the Soviets and the Chinese have had a long up and down relationship over their 40-year history. After the Soviet Union, the Russians and the Chinese have had sort of a topsy-turvy relationship. So I would remind people that just because the relations are pretty productive now does not necessarily mean they will be productive in 10, 20 years down the line. So we have to keep that into consideration as well.
Yeah. I've got a number of texts here, people asking to ask you, what's the latest on the impact of the Belt and Road, what is it called? The Belt and Road Initiative by China. It seems to have been diminished somewhat in my reading. Your thoughts?
Well, yes, it has been diminished. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that more and more countries who signed up to this initiative are sort of getting the short end of the stick. You know, I mean, in terms of paying a lot of money and hoping that the Chinese send profitable investments into their country for public infrastructure projects. And a lot of those investments have not come to fruition. So, you know, that's a lot of this is kind of a backlash against what China has promised but hasn't fulfilled. And you can see that in Africa. You certainly see that in Latin America.
Is that because of the state of their economy and the challenges that they have had?
Partly, yes. And part of this is, traditionally speaking, the, you know, when you talk about Chinese diplomacy and Chinese economic diplomacy, they have a very habitual tendency to basically promise things, and for whatever reason, they drag it out on the implementation stage. So for those who look at China and who study China for a living, you know, I ask them this. I'm like, well, you know, what is the deal with this? What is this BRI initiative? Why are so many countries sort of having second thoughts about it? And they tell me because Chinese historically are very slow implementing what they sign, whether it's an agreement or even if it's just an executive understanding.
Over promise and under deliver, in other words, right?
Exactly. In sum, yes. That's a perfect summation.
And as it relates to oil, I got a text here. How much is the oil still going to play in a lot of this decision making as to who I stand shoulder to shoulder with or otherwise?
Well, you know, in the Middle East, the United States actually does not import a lot of oil anymore. I think the last figures back, I think in September or October, 7% of America's oil comes from the Middle East, which is a huge, huge decrease from even 20 years ago. Part of that is obviously domestic production of certain oil products here in the States, as you know, in the Gulf region very well.
Right.
But, you know, just because we import less Middle Eastern oil doesn't necessarily mean that we can basically pretend that oil is not important as a global commodity, because it is a global market, right? So even if in the Middle East we import less, the price is still impacted by what goes on in that region. So it'll still be a key it'll be a key element in any decision making process in terms of the Middle East specifically.
Well, I appreciate you hanging in there, Daniel. I threw a lot at you today from different perspectives,
but a
lot of questions on the text line. You know, people just want to know, and I do as well, and we really appreciate you spending some time with us. Always appreciate the time and your insight. Thank you so much for joining us today, and have a great week.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you, sir. Daniel DePetris from the Defense Priorities. He's a Defense Priorities Fellow. I don't know why I'm having so much difficulty with that word today, but I am. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. If you've got something to offer up about this topic, give us a shout or any others. We'll be right back.